loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we have two big stories. First, the Iran nuclear deal may be circling the drain, even though Iran is in compliance with the strict pact to restrict the country's nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. The Trump administration appears determined to return to the path of all-out confrontation and wants Europe to go along with the United States. Then, we begin a new weekly series where we look at the most pressing political issues of the day. We'll take a look at electoral politics, the political parties, the most important issues at play in the coming midterm elections, the interplay between electoral politics and grassroots organizing, and we're going to take a special look at what's going on in Pennsylvania's 18th district special election.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the West Virginia teacher strike entered a surprise seventh day today after the state Senate president hinted that he would not agree to a 5% pay raise proposed by the governor. Moreover, the tentative deal between the governor and the union would not address the underfunding of the Public Employees Insurance Agency. The teachers' union had expected a five-day strike, but the rank and file insisted on keeping up the fight. Next, bitter Brexit negotiations continue between the government of Prime Minister Theresa May and the European Union. At issue are key economic policies and the future of Northern Ireland, and the fragile May government is desperate for a breakthrough. Then, the annual meeting of the Hardline American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, is this weekend in Washington, D.C., and it features senior politicians from both parties. Unpopular in his own country and in hot water in the court system there, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu will also speak. AIPAC is a powerful lobbying group that drives U.S. support for the settler project in Israel, U.S. weapons sales to Israel, and billions of dollars that this country sends them annually. This weekend, there are two rallies planned at the site of the convention. And then Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, is in big trouble. Reports suggest he's been meeting with the leaders of foreign countries not to further U.S. foreign policy goals, but to ask them for loans to prop up his family's failing real estate business. And the governments of China, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Mexico have all secretly talked about how to exploit Kushner's weaknesses. And finally, again this week, we look at the worst and most misleading headlines. In other headlines, new tapes have surfaced of EPA head Scott Pruitt expressing far-right and anti-science beliefs on a Tulsa-based radio talk show. At one point, Pruitt states that, quote, "There aren't sufficient scientific facts to establish the theory of evolution," unquote. And he replied positively after the show host stated that Islam is, quote, "not so much a religion as it is a terrorist organization in many instances," unquote. Pruitt has previously come under fire for his close ties to the fossil fuel industry and his lax approach to environmental regulation. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley traveled to Honduras this week to thank the country and its leadership and to express support for Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez. This support comes despite what critics say is his clear rigging of the election. Her positive comments are in sharp contrast to the U.S. government's attitude toward the Venezuelan elections coming up in May, which the U.S. government has preemptively declared will be rigged. Protests in Honduras gathered near the site of the visit to demonstrate against Haley. Donald Trump doubled down on his controversial new tariffs on steel and aluminum, tweeting at 5:50 this morning, quote, "When a country, USA, is losing many billions of dollars on trade with virtually every country it does business with, trade wars are good and easy to win," unquote. World leaders, including traditional U.S. allies like Canada and the European Union, reacted angrily to the tariffs. Critics of the new protectionist measures argue that they could set off a global trade war as other countries retaliate with tariffs of their own. A coordinated series of attacks struck key institutions in Ouagadougou, the capital of Burkina Faso, today, killing seven and wounding approximately 50 others. While it's unclear what group is responsible, it is widely believed to be connected to Burkina Faso's participation in the G5 alliance of Sahel nations, combating jihadist organizations in the region, including Al-Qaeda and Boko Haram. The attack targeted the country's military headquarters as well as the French embassy. At least two people were shot and killed today in a dorm at Central Michigan University. Neither of those victims were students. The suspect is still at large. The university is calling it a family-related domestic incident. This comes not even 3 weeks after the mass shooting in Florida. Those are today's headlines. Next up is an interview on the Iran Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
We turn now to the concerted effort by the Trump administration to sabotage the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran Nuclear Arms Deal. We're joined from Arlington, Virginia by Gareth Porter. He is a historian, investigative journalist, and analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy and the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And we're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. Gareth and Mark, thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Brian, John, always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you both. Gareth, it's quite clear as we approach what I believe is the May 12th deadline for Trump to certify compliance, Iran's compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that the Trump administration has signaled the European signatories, or at least some of them, that the Trump insists on a, quote, fix to the nuclear arms deal, which would mean a second part of the deal, something that Iran and probably China and Russia will say no to. But let's get the big picture here. Iran is in compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Trump is seeking to sabotage it. It seems to me from a distance that while the sort of the mantra in the past couple months was this would isolate the United States, that the European powers seem to be kowtowing to the Trump administration, or at least some of the European powers. Go ahead.
I think it remains to be seen whether the Europeans are going to kowtow to Washington or not. I mean, it certainly could happen. And the reason, of course, as I think many of your listeners may be aware, is that the United States, as always, is going to use every bit of power that has available to muscle the EU3, that is Britain, France, and Germany, to knuckle under to the U.S. demand that they come up with something with the Iranians. And that power, of course, is that if the Europeans don't go along with this and they do business with Iran under the JCPOA, as it's required by the JCPOA, the United States will cut off their financial access to U.S. financial institutions. And that is a very, very sizable leverage that the U.S. has. Now, the Europeans have talked about, at least initially in the last few weeks, the possibility of having their own legislation that would protect their businesses, their business firms, who are prepared to do business with Iran, and to say that the U.S. will not be able to reach them. But that's not going to resolve the problem of their being denied access to financial institutions in the United States. So that is a big question mark. I agree. At the same time, it's not clear where that's going to take us in terms of how the fix is going to be brought about. I mean, the Iranians are simply not going to negotiate. And so to insist on negotiating, I mean, the Europeans are saying, well, we won't negotiate a fix to the JCPOA itself, but we will negotiate with Iran on a new agreement that somehow extends beyond the JCPOA. And the Iranians obviously are not going to do that. So that means we're headed towards a crisis, and that much we can be sure of, I think.
This all sounds and feels to me like a self-fulfilling prophecy, as though Donald Trump, well, not even as though, we all know that Donald Trump never intended to respect the JCPOA. He never intended to try to continue the Obama administration's policy of improving relations with Iran, and he's got his own personal interests among the Gulf countries that want to see this whole deal collapse, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, etc. Wasn't that the plan all along? Just to get the JCPOA to collapse, but at the same time to make it look like it wasn't Donald Trump's fault, that it was the agreement's fault because the agreement was untenable? Mark Sloboda.
Yeah, I think that is exactly what's driving a lot of what is going on here. I think that, you know, the Trump administration, even during its campaign, while it talked realism and at least towards Russia and some other foreign policy elements that some would regard as improvement, disavowing regime change and democratization and nation building, it had always been very virulent against Iran. And now with the neocons pretty much in the driving seat of the Trump administration's foreign policy completely, and the Trump administration having crawled up pretty much as far into bed with both Israel and Saudi Arabia, both who would like to see this deal collapse, and are both really gnawing at the possibility of military action against Iran, the tripod of the three, would need U.S. involvement in that. I think that's really what's driving things at this point. I think that the Trump administration push to make the Europeans reform or create an addendum to the JCPOA is kind of smokescreen. I think they want the deal to collapse at this point. And I have to reiterate something that Gareth was talking about, that the U.S. and Iran do very little business, and there is no perspective for U.S. companies to do business, even the energy companies in Iran, when they know the Trump administration's positions towards that. What the Trump administration is threatening by not renewing the removal of sanctions, that's 120 days that he has to do, he's actually threatening Europe. This is sanctions against European businesses and blackmail against Europe. This is threatening a trade war with Europe, because what he's really threatening is financial sanctions against any European companies, and we're looking at particularly European financial and energy companies that would start to do business Iran. And this was a principal reason why Iran agreed to the JCPOA in the first place, is because they wanted foreign investment and expertise, particularly in the energy sector. And they have been complaining to the UN, responsible for the JCPOA, to the International Atomic Energy Agency, that it's not getting what it wanted out of the deal, because European companies are afraid to invest or do business in Iran right now because of the Trump administration's bluster and position. Europe is quite reasonably upset about all of this. And this comes on the back of the fact that there is already a large divide between Washington and Brussels and London on not only this, but many issues, right? There was a division between Europe and the U.S. The U.S. is from Mars, Europe is from Venus, back during the George W. Bush years. This has returned, and it has the potential to be really on steroids because of differences on so many positions.
Gareth Porter, let me bring it back to you. I'm looking at a Foreign Policy magazine article authored by Richard Goldberg. It was published October 2nd, 2017. I'll just do the headline and then get your reaction, because the headline in a way says it all, even though there have been, again, as we started this program, all these assertions, well, the U.S. will be completely isolated if it, unlike all the other signers of the JCPOA, says that Iran is out of compliance when, in fact, Iran is in compliance. The headline of the article reads, "If the U.S. reimposes sanctions on Iran, allies will follow. Cry as they might along the way, no European or Asian corporation is going to choose a terrorist regime over access to the U.S. dollar." Now, of course, you can tell by the nature of the headline that the author has his own biases. But that's in stark contrast to, say, the comments of Adam Zubin, former director of the U.S. Office of Foreign Assets Control, who wrote, "We will not be able to coerce Europe, Russia, and China into shunning Iran's economy over policy interests that they do not share." They do not share those policy interests, but if the U.S. sanctions the Iran Central Bank, if it shuts off its ability to access international credit, if it threatens to sanction companies or banks that do business with Iran Central Bank necessary to facilitate trade, international trade with Iran, it seems to me that that's right, that the author is right one way or the other. These European part of the Joint Comprehensive Plan, these signers will opt for the United States, even if they don't agree with the policy.
It's very possible that that will happen. I agree. And of course, that will then bring a crisis with regard to Iran, because the Iranians are not going to go along with the continued undermining, massive violation of the terms of the JCPOA, as they should not be expected to do so. And so therefore, they will make it clear that their compliance with the agreement will be similarly limited, and that they will take steps to defend themselves, quote unquote. And I think that we're then back to a situation essentially pre-JCPOA, before the negotiations reached their final agreement in 2015. And I think, what we're really looking at here is yet another installment in what is now a decades-long drama of neither war nor peace between the United States and Iran. I mean, the fact is the United States government is unwilling to reach any kind of normal relationship, to make possible any normal relationship with Iran, must continue to put pressure, both military and economic pressure, on Iran, which is bound to create some backlash from the Iranians. But at the same time, the United States is not willing to go to war with Iran, even though there's great fear of a United States attacking Iran or Israel attacking Iran. That I don't think is going to happen, because a very powerful interest in the United States, which is the Pentagon and the armed services, have no interest. In fact, they do not want any sort of war with Iran. And so therefore, I think we are going to see a continuation of this state of drama, which is neither war nor peace, well into the future.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking about the Iran Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And we're speaking from Arlington, Virginia, with Gareth Porter. He is a historian, investigative journalist, and analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy, and he's also the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And we're also speaking with Mark Sloboda. He's joining us from Moscow. He is an international affairs and security analyst. Gareth, following up on your last point, I want to ask you something simple. Are the Iranians in compliance, and what exactly are they in compliance with?
Well, I'm glad you asked the question, because the plain, simple answer is that the Iranians are fully in compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and that agreement is a very carefully negotiated pact between the United States, Europeans, European Three, the Russians, Chinese, and the Iranians. And that agreement was reached because the Obama administration decided that it had to give up its demand, unilateral demand on Iran, that it drop completely its enrichment program, except for possibly a simply symbolic gesture of allowing enrichment, but nothing more, and actually negotiate with Iran for the first time on its nuclear program. Up to that time, the U.S. had simply unilaterally made demands that could not possibly be met, or the Iranians had no intention of meeting them. So in my view, very carefully considered after all these years is that the JCPOA is not just unnecessary, as I've always argued it was, because Iran had no interest in getting nuclear weapons, never has had an interest in getting nuclear weapons, but it's actually a bad thing because it prolongs this crisis and, of course, gives the United States a kind of legitimacy for the policy that has been following for many years toward Iran. So I think the JCPOA is in many ways deeply troubling. It's deeply troublesome, if you will, in terms of the problem of moving U.S.-Iran relations towards some sort of normalization.
Mark Sloboda, same question to you. That's an interesting thesis from Gareth Porter. I want to also, because you are a security and military analyst as well, I want to also throw into the mix here that Iran is signaling at this point, and just recently, more recent announcements, that it plans to build nuclear-powered ships. Iran, this is from DW.com, Iran has disclosed plans to develop nuclear reactors for ships despite a deal with world powers that curtail its atomic program. The project, well, this is a ridiculous part of the caption, the project is likely to get a cool response from Washington. Yes, it is. Anyway, I want you to react, if you would, Mark, to Gareth's main point there and also talk about Iran's military plans, especially with the nuclear-powered ships.
Yeah. First of all, I'd just like to stress again that it's not just our opinion or the Europeans' opinion or Russian opinion that Iran is fully in compliance with the agreements that were struck between the U.S., Iran, and all these major world powers officiated by the U.N. It is the U.N.'s International Atomic Energy Agency responsible for overseeing the JCPOA that also says that Iran is fully in compliance. When pressed, even the Trump administration agrees that technically Iran is in compliance. Then they make noises about things that aren't part of the program, like ballistic missiles that are under some other UN sanctions but aren't part of the JCPOA. And they're very unhappy with the sunset clauses within the JCPOA that would expire in 2030 or past. And these are specifically about the limits to the amount and the extent to which Iran can enrich uranium. And Iran had, there's no evidence that Iran ever had any nuclear weapons program. What the U.S. was, what they really talk about behind closed doors, as it were, behind technical, is Iran's breakthrough technology possibility, where they would have enough experience and enough partially enriched uranium on hand, which they are allowed for their civilian nuclear power program, which is completely legal and actually their right under international law, and that's guaranteed under the JCPOA, but that they would have sufficient enrichment experience and capability to, in a relatively short period of time, enact a nuclear weapons program. And that's actually what the U.S. Has really been aiming at, preventing any nuclear enrichment in Iran. And that's why so many are unhappy with the JCPOA, because it doesn't do that. And this recent proposal by Iran to begin building nuclear-powered ships, I'm not sure how actually useful, as a former nuclear engineer in the U.S. Navy. I was a reactor operator in the U.S. Navy. I'm not sure how useful this would be really for the Iranian Navy. And the U.S. has dropped all of their nuclear ships except for carriers and submarines. Possibly Iran could benefit from some nuclear-powered submarines, but this would be a long program to build. This would be decades long in order to build up nuclear submarines or so on. And that would be perfectly legal according to, you know, both international law and the JCPOA. But it would also allow Iran to make arguments about the amount of Iran that they are legally allowed to produce, to enrich to a degree that would be possible for those reactors. Now, that is still far below the enrichment that would be necessary for a weapon. But it's kind of a poke in the eye of the U.S. In that direction, in that they still have a nuclear enrichment program at all. However, it is limited by the GCPA that really drives fury in Washington, Riyadh, and in Israel as well.
Gareth Porter, I've said on this show a couple of times that the JCPOA has pushed us economically beyond a point of no return, in that we've got economic relations now with the Iranians, whether the conservatives in this country like it or not. We have Boeing selling billions of dollars in equipment and spare parts. We have other U.S. companies exporting to Iran. And certainly the Europeans have now deepening economic relations. But I think now maybe I was wrong when I said that I believed that. Now it looks like with the Trump administration's threats to European countries, and especially to European banks, of sanctions if they don't stop doing business with Iran, that's going to be a setback for everybody. Tell us what will happen to the United States and to the European countries economically if this deal goes down the drain.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there are always going to be competing business interests, as well as interests that are not business at all, but bureaucratic interests that are going to bear on and influence the policy of the United States. And in this case, I mean, it's clear that there are a lot of businesses that would like to have an opening to Iran, you know, just as there are businesses that would like to have a much greater opening to Russia in terms of investment and trade. And that is a very significant possibility in terms of a total addition to U.S. Gross national product, gross domestic product. And so there's no doubt, I mean, I don't have the figures in my head at this point, but I have seen some figures that suggest that it would be a very significant addition to the U.S. economy. But at the same time, of course, you have the competing interests, primarily bureaucratic, that represent particularly the interests of Israel, the interests of the Sunni Arab allies, the Saudis, the UAE, and people who are the neocons in the administration and outside, whose ideological interests lie in threatening and, if possible, actually having a war between the United States and Iran. I mean, they've been trying to do this for well over a decade now. And so, you know, this game that's been playing out since the Clinton administration, basically, is going to continue because there are such powerful interests in this country, political interests, both, you know, in terms of the U.S. allies, the Israelis and the Arab allies, on one hand, and political constituencies that Trump now is representing, but which the Republican Party has become very close to as well, that are determined to maintain a state of high tension with Iran, and if possible, even they would like to see war. But as I say, I mean, I don't think that's possible because Iran has too much defensive power. We haven't talked about their missile force yet, but that's obviously at stake in the current crisis over the JCPOA and then the Trump administration's policy and the EU, because the United States wants the Iranians to give up their missile program, and they're not going to do it. But the Iranians do have a significant deterrent from their own ballistic missile program and from the Hezbollah missiles that they have helped to provide. And they can do great damage to Israel, as well as to U.S. bases and allies in the region. So, you know, there is, in fact, a standoff here that that prevents the right-wing, if you will, anti-Iran contingent politically in this country from achieving its goal.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Arlington, Virginia, by Gareth Porter. He's a historian, investigative journalist, and analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy. He's the author of Manufactured Crises, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And we've been joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we begin a new weekly series where we look at the most pressing political topics of the day. We'll look at electoral politics, the political parties, and the most important issues at play in the upcoming midterm election. We're joined in studio by our new regular guests, Jacqueline and Abdushahid Luqman. They are the co-editors-in-chief of Luqman Nation. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I want to start by talking about this fascinating race. Special election in Pennsylvania's 18th district. For our listeners who don't know Pennsylvania very well, it's in the southwestern corner of Pennsylvania, the Pittsburgh exurbs. It's very white and very conservative. There was a congressman there, a Republican, Tim Murphy, very popular, but he got caught up in a sex scandal and had to resign. So now the seat is open. The candidates are a Republican, state legislator named Saccone. And then the Democrat is a former U.S. Deputy U.S. Attorney, Assistant U.S. Attorney named Lamb. I think everybody is surprised that this race is as close as it is, and it can't get any closer. I was in Pittsburgh I was in Pittsburgh yesterday and the day before. And I can tell you that there are political ads on the major radio stations literally every minute or two. Almost all of the ads that I heard were Saccone's ads, the Republican. But the Cook Political Report, which just moved this race from lean Republican to toss-up, says that the Republican ads and the Republican accusations against Lamb just are not sticking. So tell us a little bit about this race and what you think is happening in southwestern Pennsylvania. And also, do you think that this is a trend? Are we going to see this in other purple states that went Trump in the 2016 election?
Yeah, I do believe that this is the beginning of a trend. And I think that for the Democratic Party, this is like their litmus test, even more so than Alabama and Virginia were, because of a couple of factors, I think, because of the gerrymandering issue that the GOP had in Pennsylvania, where when they took control of the House in Pennsylvania, they redrew the districts and basically created GOP safe districts, completely isolated Pittsburgh and made it a predominantly black, predominantly Democratic, one little island in the middle of a sea of a created gerrymandered district. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court struck that down, said obviously that was unconstitutional. And it's interesting that even with the gerrymandering that was done by a Republican House, this race in the 18th district is as close as it is, because even though the Supreme Court has issued new congressional maps, those maps don't actually take effect until after the special election.
This is the gerrymandered Republican district.
Yes.
And we have to remember, too, that Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton in this district by 20 percentage points.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Which
mm-hmm.
says a lot.
Well, I think that another thing that point out to me when you said that you saw the amount of ads that was against Lamb shows me that the Republicans are becoming desperate, because Lamb was outpacing him with the fundraising and gaining money. So now the fact that ads tell us, because they're expensive, so that lets me know that Saccone is gaining some outside help, that the Republicans now see this as, you know, we have to circle the wagons here. To your other point about, will this be a trend in other GOP gerrymandering districts? I think that if Lamb wins this, I see that the DNC is going to say that, hey, we got something here. Do I think that would be a big win for progressives? No.
Well, you know what? Let's talk about some polls, too. Well, I want to make one point first before we turn to the polls. You're right about the fundraising. Lamb made a very interesting comment on KDKA radio yesterday. That's the big flagship station in Pittsburgh. He said that outside Republican groups, not the Saccone campaign, but outside Republican groups are spending $1 million a day on advertising to defeat him. So let me talk about a couple of polls here. And this is why I'm going to respectfully disagree with you. I think that this may be a wave coming. Normally, if there's going to be a big changeover from one party to another in the House of Representatives. The generic Democratic versus Republican vote in polls is between 4 and 7 percentage points. So these are the latest polls. From yesterday, we have Democrats up by 15. Wednesday, Democrats up by 6. Democrats up by 12. Monday, Democrats up by 16. Last Friday, Democrats up by 7. These are tsunami kind of numbers. The Cook Political Report, which is nonpartisan and probably the most highly respected observer of politics in America, says that the Democrats are looking at picking up between 26 and 40 House seats. And again, this is with those gerrymandered districts. It's not just Pennsylvania that's been gerrymandered. It's so many states. We've already seen lawsuits in places like Wisconsin and North Carolina, and Florida and Pennsylvania. So this has the possibility to be a watershed kind of election, like 1974, 1980.
Right. Yeah, I do agree that, again, I think this is if the Democrats win this race, and I actually think they will.
I have to tell you, I didn't a week ago.
I didn't.
But I do now.
When I first heard about this race, and when I saw, you know, the area that we're talking about coal country here. You know, this is what we always think of coal country as being like West Virginia, Appalachia.
No, this is solid
this
coal
is
country.
Solid
definitely.
Coal country. Coal and energy production are like the leading employers in this district. This is a district that is like you said, 97% white. The median income is $45,000 a year. So we're not talking about a bunch of out of touch, wealthy, college kind of elite sort of. No, we're talking about literally almost middle America.
Yeah, this is America right here.
Yeah, and these are people who recognize that all of the threats that were coming from the Saccone ads, where you were saying that where they were threatening that that Conor Lamb is trying to take your guns.
You're right.
Well, after 8 years of Obama, these people, like my husband said, these people are not unintelligent. These people have figured out after 8 years of being threatened that Obama was going to take their guns. Nobody from the Obama administration actually showed up and took their guns. That kind of rhetoric is not working with them anymore.
And Conor Lamb told the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette yesterday that the only change he would make when it comes to guns is he would demand background investigations for gun sales at gun shows. Well, 75% of Americans agree with that.
But see, but that I want to clarify my point why I said that if Lamb wins, I don't see and say if Democratic candidates like Lamb win. As you said about the tsunami seems to be the Democratic Party. When I said that, I don't think that it's a big win for progressive. If Lamb wins, look at what Lamb is doing.
Yes.
He's not for Medicare for all, right?
He's not for single payer.
Right. He's not for single payer. All of the issues that progressives are embracing or want the Democratic Party to embrace is not within Lamb. He's a moderate. He's a centralist. And I'm afraid that if we have more candidates like him, and we do have this tsunami, then what does that represent for the progressive cause in this country?
Well, that's the age-old conversation is do you become the big tent party and you have a faction of blue dog Democrats that are anti-abortion and pro-gun, or are you looking for more ideological purity? It looks like the Democratic leadership is still struggling with that because just yesterday, and this is a race in Illinois, there's a congressman, Dan Lipinski, a conservative Democrat who's very solidly pro-life. And the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee announced that they would not send him any money for his reelection campaign. Well, today, Nancy Pelosi came out and said that she would campaign for him, not as the House Minority Leader, but as Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. So we're still seeing this split within the party where they don't know really what to do with the likes of Bob Casey, for example, who was not allowed to speak at the Democratic convention because he's pro-life.
Right. And then we have the other example down in Pennsylvania 16th district with Jess King and Christiana Harmon.
I think her name is Harmon.
So we have the same issue down there where you have Jess King, who's basically an outsider coming in. She's got dissed by Emily's List, you know, and then at the same time, Christiana Harmon, she already lost. And,
right,
and
lost a previous
race.
Right,
and I mean, that's after she's done everything right that she's supposed to do.
According to the Democratic
Party. According to the Democratic Party. And she still lost. And then now you got Rendell, who's saying, oh, but well, we're going to back her again. You know, outside. And then you have Jess King, who is gaining ground, getting a groundswell of support. And, you know, again, it's like, well, we're going to back the losing horse.
Because they espouse the Democratic centrist ideals that are not progressive. We're going to stick with the corporate message. We're not going to scare off our corporate backers. And I think that's the interesting thing in the 18th. And like you said, Abdus, in the 16th also, and I think it's what we're going to see in all of the other races that are in these midterms. I don't think we're going to see Democrats or the DCC, the DCCC, throwing any money at candidates who are progressives.
Indeed. And let's just help the audience remember, because people don't have a very long memory.
Yeah.
In 2008, the Democrats won big in the House, and they won big in the Senate. They had 59 votes in the Senate, almost veto-proof. They had a very popular president. We were all down there on the inaugural parade route, 3 million plus people, the biggest inauguration ever. People thought when George W. Bush went away in the helicopter, everybody was shooting him the middle finger.
Oh, yeah.
3 million
middle fingers.
I remember it like
yesterday. Yep.
People thought, well, not only is Bush leaving Washington, but the Bush era is ending. And that meant a lot of things. It meant a lot in terms of potential changes in domestic policy, certainly foreign policy, certainly the issue of war and peace. But we had a situation, a constellation of forces in the House, and this speaks to the point that I think both of you are making, that the Democrats really could have done whatever they wanted to do. They could have done whatever they wanted to do. They had the votes, and they did whatever they wanted to do. And it wasn't improve Medicare for all. It wasn't a progressive agenda. It was taking basically a repackaged Republican health care plan, the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
And trying to seek the Democratic leadership under those conditions were not looking to their left. They were looking to their right. They were trying to build support among Blue Dog Democrats and among Republicans. And as a consequence, we came up with a plan, the Affordable Care Act, which, while a big improvement for many people who didn't have any access to health care, it's not really affordable. It's very vulnerable to being attacked. The bottom line is that the insurance companies must have their guaranteed profits in order for the system to work. And the Republicans called it communism anyway, even though it was their plan.
It was Obamacare, remember that?
Yeah, Obamacare.
Right.
And so here's the thing, and again, we have, like in the election of Doug Jones against Roy Moore, it wasn't the Democratic National Committee, the centrist Democratic National Committee. It was rank and file, mainly black women in Alabama that led to the victory of Doug Jones. And as soon as he takes office, he starts cavorting with Donald Trump. And the whole logic of this thing is we have to keep moving further and further to the right so that we can win again. And of course, you know, it's like Kurt Vonnegut said in his novel Mother Night, you are what you pretend to be, so be careful when you pretend. If you pretend to be a Republican, if you pretend to be a conservative, if you pretend to be pro-Wall Street and not for Medicare for all or not for expanded jobs or job training or higher wages, guess what? The people who really need those things and who could be counted on as a voting base for the Democratic Party just won't be excited.
I agree. And I think one of the negative effects of that Republican light strategy that they're doing is that we already live in a country that has the lowest voter turnout in the Western world. And I think that when you can't distinguish between the two, and when people get tired of trying to distinguish between the two, the only thing it's going to do is negatively impact voter turnout. And that's what I see.
And this is actually the idea that you can't distinguish between the two parties anymore is not even an old, or rather, it's not even a new phenomenon. We've talked about this for probably 3 years. In 1956, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote an essay that was published in The Nation magazine where he explained why he wasn't going to vote in the upcoming elections. And the very issues that people are being exposed to now in our broken electorate, where we have a two-party monopoly on politics where third parties can't even get their messages out because of the stranglehold of the two-party system and populist policies don't get any traction. That was true in 1956.
Sure it was.
And these were things that W.E.B. Du Bois said at the time were the things that were causing progress in political advocacy to stall for Black people. So, and this is true today, but now it's not just Black people being affected by this situation, this duopoly in our political system. Now it's everybody.
Yeah. You know, I was having an opportunity to go through some old artifacts from someone who passed away not too long ago, and she had kept campaign literature from the 50s and the 40s and other materials. And I found these leaflets for Adlai Stevenson in 1956. And the attack that the Democratic Party, this is the liberal Adlai Stevenson attacking Eisenhower, was that he was not attacking Eisenhower because he wasn't a, quote, real friend of Israel. And that the evidence of this was that he wanted normal relations with Nasser and the Egyptian government after the Egyptian revolution.
See, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, we're talking about, you know, 60 years ago in the middle of the 50s, the terrible 50s. Of course, there was the other thing that was going on in the 60s, of course, which was Montgomery in 1955, and then the sort of crusade that began to desegregate public transportation, followed by what can only be called the civil rights revolution in many ways, even though it didn't result in a revolutionary overturn of power. It certainly changed the climate and the fabric and ended the formal apartheid state in big parts of America, the formal apartheid state, at least, from a point of view of political revolutions, a big achievement. None of that came from Congress. That came from below. Congress sort of ratified that in the 1964 Civil Rights Act and 65 Voting Rights Act. But that's what I think the discordancy is right now. Like what we're seeing in this state, in this district that voted so overwhelmingly for Trump, and now you see it could possibly go Democrat. That shows that there's an aspiration. There's a desire for change.
That's right.
Right. Mm-hmm. I agree.
The question is that by itself doesn't mean the change will come.
No, and you're exactly right on all of those points. And this is the problem of the Democratic leadership in Congress. Looking at Nancy Pelosi specifically, have the Democrats learned nothing from the 1994 contract with America? They mocked it back then, and they ended up being swept out of office. The American people want to know what a party stands for.
Right.
And every 2 years, the Democrats approach an election, and they don't tell anybody what they stand for.
Exactly. Which I always said is, I think that failure to do that is going to guarantee, at least maybe we might see these incremental changes within the gerrymandering districts and all. Maybe Democrats would take over. But I think as far as the presidency go, I think that I'd predict that unless the Democrats distinguish themselves from the Republicans, we're going to see another Republican president, Donald Trump, or maybe some other Republican president. But they have to distinguish themselves of what they stand for.
And I think that the one way that because I think Connor Lamb has a unique opportunity here to make progressivism appealing to this very unique population in Pennsylvania, because here you have the 18th district is also like the second oldest electorate in the state. So you have people who receive their medical care basically from, you know, their employer, from their former employer. Right. But here's a candidate who is not supportive of Medicare for all. And he's not because he doesn't want to anger the business lobby, because their argument is that we don't want to have to or I'm sorry, he's not supportive of a $15 minimum wage.
Right. He's not.
So he's not supportive of that because he doesn't want to anger the business lobby, because the business lobby's argument is that if we raise wages, then we have to take that money from somewhere else. And guess where that's going to be? Your medical benefits, probably your pensions. But if he frames the argument for Medicare for all, or whatever you want to call it, universal health care, Medicare expansion, whatever, he can frame the argument and say, you know what? if you or your employer didn't have to pay for medical care, wouldn't matter how much we paid people. You could have the medical care you need and people could get paid a living wage and employers don't have to worry about the cost for medical care and you don't have to worry about losing medical care or possibly going bankrupt for medical care. But that's not, and that's an easy pitch, right? It seems like such an easy pitch.
It's kind of the weirdness of America, actually. I mean, it really is weird because if you look at all the other advanced industrial countries, there's not a right-left split on healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even a class division on healthcare. It's not like the capitalist employers don't want a national health plan. They, as you're pointing out, actually do, because then it's not on them. Here in the United States, it's almost like there would have to be a revolution to get something that's just an assumed guaranteed right.
Yeah, everywhere
and, you know,
else.
And Michael Moore made the point in the movie Sicko, not to diverge too much, but what the heck? Let's diverge a little bit. I mean, in the movie, he said in the countries where the government is afraid of the people, people have health care.
Right.
But in the countries like the United States where people are afraid of the government, where, in other words, they don't feel their own power, they don't feel their own capacity, they haven't been learned or taught or experienced the power of independent grassroots action as the determinant, and then they don't have these rights. And this is a fundamental right. Like the people who are sick have a right to vote every 2 years for Congress people who won't give them the right to go to a doctor.
Right. Exactly.
And that's the essence of our democracy. Like we get the homeless have the right to vote every 2 years, but they don't have the right to a home. I mean, this is the kind of fundamental paradox, or paradox is too soft, unworthiness of the word democracy as applied to this particular system.
And also to add to that, Brian, is that, and not to diverge too much, the weirdness of America that you're talking about. I mean, this society, we've been kind of conditioned to believe ourselves as just frustrated millionaires. We just haven't gotten ours yet. And if we look at it, how rooted it is historically, and we look at during the first example of capitalism in this country, which is slavery, and we find out why so many poor whites supported the aristocracy of the South, the plantation class, because they just felt like, okay, if I work hard, I can own a few slaves too.
Right.
You know, so that's the reason why it was so hard in the beginning to really get this groundswell opposition against slavery. So we're still seeing these dynamics being played out now.
Very, very true. And I think let's talk about that a little bit, because this is such a big part also of the weirdness of America, is the intertangling of politics, race, and class.
Yes.
And it plays out over and over and over again. So you have, of course, like when we think back to the 1980s, there was the 1984 Jesse Jackson campaign. The 84 campaign was like an insurgency against the Democratic Party, which was excluding any manifestation of black political power. In the 88 campaign, because Jackson had shown that he had the capacity to reach white workers, including areas, white working class areas, and I was able to travel a little bit during that same time period, white working class areas where there were no black people, and people were chanting, "Run, Jesse, run."
Right. Right.
I mean,
right.
Including thousands of miners in, you know, West Virginia and Kentucky, because he had sort of an anti-corporate appeal that sort of transcended the normal divisions. So here you had white working class people supporting a black candidate who was very associated with the black civil rights movement because he was appealing to them on a class basis. And that seems to me the thing that Bernie Sanders, well, maybe he would have done better over a longer period of time, but he wasn't oriented, at least in the beginning, in that direction. Jackson didn't have to orient because he was a leader from the black struggle for equality. Sanders had to prove something. He had to become known in the black community. But again, when you look at change in America, where did we get unions? Where did we get unemployment insurance? Where did we get Social Security? Where did we get Medicare? Where did we get the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act? Unless it's this kind of chemistry where you have the anti-racist, so to speak, struggle and the class orientation coming together in a militant sort of confrontation of one type or another, and militant can mean different things to different people, but that kind of confrontational mode with the powers that be, we don't get change. We just keep spinning our wheels. And I think that's what's, again, missing. And I'm fearful, John, like that the Democrats will will look at the midterm election and say, well, if only we can be Republican enough.
Right. And they make that mistake every 2 years. Mm-hmm. Every 2 years. And not just at the congressional level. You know, the Republicans control more state houses and state legislatures right now than they have at any other time in American history. And the Democrats, if they think that just winning back the House this year is going to transform somehow the party, they're sadly mistaken.
No, I agree.
This is a fight that's going to have to be waged for a decade, at least.
Oh, I definitely agree.
Yeah. And I've heard this said by many people, Nina Turner has said it, other people who are the left wing of the Democratic Party. We are fighting for the soul of the Democratic Party. We're not just fighting for the soul of this nation here, which we are, which we always have been. But really, those of us who are on the left end of the political spectrum, we are fighting for the soul of the Democratic Party. And if races like this one in the 18th of Pennsylvania portend anything, it portends that for those of us who are really looking for, as you said, Brian, a revolutionary change. And I know revolutionary is a frightening word for some people, but we
celebrate it in school.
We do. It's only frightening when other people want a revolution.
As long as it's 200 years ago, it's great.
Right. But if we really want a revolutionary change in policies for people in this country, these races don't, even if the Democrats win them all, even if we do get this blue tsunami that I really think will happen, nothing's going to change for people as far as policies are concerned.
Yeah, it almost never does.
And at some point, we've really got to start asking ourselves, how long are we going to keep voting for these people who keep demanding our votes, making a bunch of promises, and then when we put them in office, deliver on none of them?
And, you know, there's so much to complain about with Donald Trump, and that's why there's so much desire for change, and where, again, these areas that voted Trump now could go in the opposite direction. But again, the Democrats, if you listen to them, they're not talking really about the Dreamers or immigration or wages or jobs or Medicare for all. They're completely fixated on Trump is the stooge of the Russians or colluding with Russia. And I have to tell you, if you go to West Virginia or to Michigan or Pennsylvania or Ohio or any of those states where working class people are suffering and looking for anything to change, they don't give a darn about this, nor do they actually believe it. They don't actually think that Donald Trump, weird, maverick, freaky Donald Trump, is the president of the United States. Because Russia threw in with him.
Nobody believes that. No.
It's the Democrats, again, shooting themselves not in one, but both feet, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. We are just about out of time, but I wanted to put a little seed out there. Maybe we can talk about it next week. The Ohio governor, John Kasich, who ran against Trump and really didn't do very well, he only won his own state of Ohio, has made several trips, three so far, to New Hampshire. He's also been speaking with the outgoing governor of Colorado, Governor Hickenlooper. And there's talk, they're both denying it so far, but there's talk that they may run for president and vice president, either on an independent ticket or for the Libertarians. It's something that I think the Republicans are starting to worry about. Kasich and Hickenlooper don't want to talk too much about it, but I think it's something that is going to be a lot of fun to watch in the coming 6 or 8 months. So anyway, that's gonna be about it for us. We'll wrap it up. We were joined in studio by our new regular guests, Jacqueline and Abdushahid Luqman. They are the co-editors-in-chief of Luqman Nation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.